The visiting poet for Fall 2011 at SPLAB is Brenda Hillman. She's published 8 collections of poetry, all from Wesleyan University Press, the latest of which is Practical Water, which came out in 2009. She's edited an edition of Emily Dickinson's poetry for Shambhala Publications and co-edited The Grand Permission, New Writings on Poetics and Motherhood. Among her awards include the 2005 William Carlos Williams Prize for Poetry, fellowships from the NEA and the Guggenheim Foundation. She is the Olivia Filippi Professor of Poetry at St. Mary's College in Moraga, California, a member of the permanent faculties of the Napa Valley Writers Conference and of the Squaw Valley Community of Writers. And she's also involved in nonviolent activism as a member of the Code Pink Working Group in the San Francisco Bay Area. And that was a good link for the talk that happened last night, Innovation and Activism in Poetry. But first, Brenda, before we get into that, I love your story about the plane from Oakland to Seattle and a non-poet, a civilian, a normal person, however you want to say it. She said, so what kind of poetry do you write? And it's like, wow, how do I, you know, put this in terms that a layperson will understand? And you said two things, spiritual nature poetry that experiments with form and innovative lyric. And how did she respond to that?
Well, you know, people, it's kind of a conversation stopper because it they usually the follow-up murmur is something like, well, I don't read much poetry. And at that point, I think the follow-up answer should be, well, it's still in you. And if you don't read it, then it's not that you should. It's that, oh, I'm sorry, because it would help your life so much. So we talked about female relationships and grandchildren and children and daughters and. And it was a nice conversation. I brought poetry back into it. So, you know, you can feel as if you've opened the door to remind them that it's out there, that it's there.
And you don't have to wait until somebody dies to start getting interested in it.
That's right, yeah. And that you need poetry throughout your life, and that just because you gave it up doesn't mean you didn't once have it, because they know that that it's there for them. I think they know that it's there for them, or they wouldn't turn to these sort of talismanic uses of it at various points in their existence. Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's a situation like if they don't engage poetry on some level, then something comes in to fill the void, like advertising or something like that?
Well, yes, and another way of saying it is one thing that my husband Bob Haas says whenever I'm sort of hypercritical of somebody's attention to something that seems to me, you know, kind of an irrelevant matter of achievement in the world. He'll say, like, you know, becoming good at some very very small kind of aspect of a subject matter, he'll say, well, it's their poem, you know. And so I think everyone does have their poem if to be obsessively spiritually engaged in some discipline or being good at something is what poetry one thing poetry does for your soul. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how would you elaborate to someone who knows a little bit about poetry about those two things that you told this person to describe your poetry?
You mean in terms of the nature? Yeah. Well, I guess in fancier sort of more poetics terms, my poetry comes out of a long interest in the continuum since the Romantics of the engagement with the non-human world of plants, animals, the wild, as Gary Snyder might say, and our place in it. I would say, you know, eco-poetics is the term that's being commonly used, but the sense that we're part of a greater nature, a greater environment than just the human mind. And my interest in the so-called spiritual, which is also a sort of questionable term, is that to me, interest in the invisible and the non-human natures does include a sense of mysterious consciousness that may not be human. And so I'm interested in touching on those things. And there's a third element that I didn't get into with the woman because I could sort of sense that that would fall badly. Has to do with the socio-political and our connection between the human language in our society, in our world, and our political and ethical responsibilities as artists.
So to call out doublespeak and other instances of use of language to control or to obfuscate.
Right, exactly. And we were talking last night about some of the terms that are put on put on the culture in a like a brand in a violent way, like the word use of the word drone, which is obviously the worker bee. But the sense of the robot, and enhanced techniques for torture, enhanced interrogation techniques. I mean, it's an unacceptable sort of brutalization of language for the wrong reasons.
You're talking, I think it was at dinner last night, about your mom who would talk to the plants and other things like that. So maybe that kind of gave you a sense of the sentience of all things. Would you say that's a fair estimation?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a what I think of as a kind of interior Protestant tradition. I grew up Baptist, and one of the things that surprised me as I sort of went to college and began to read about esoteric, Western metaphysics, is that that the Baptist, the sort of quietist Protestant traditions, also have a real connection with Gnosticism, with the sort of occult, even with a strange kind of anarchic spiritual state, which puts you in connection directly with the divine. Now, mostly in American Protestantism, this has become very rigid and programmatic in terms of, contacting Jesus in this very specific way according to the scriptures. But it isn't mediated by necessarily by, by other saints. So it seems to me that what the connection between maybe animism and American Protestantism and esoteric things like theosophy that interests me as well, Gnosticism, does have to do with this sense of immediate entrance into a strange connection with things, with the other, with encounters with animal spirits or even, animated objects. And so, the specific example is that my mother, when we grew up, she talked to plants, and she still talks to plants, like, come on, baby, come on, honey. Just touching the leaf and like encouraging it, and it wasn't a sort of New Agey thing. This was before the sort of New Agey thing. Like if you talk to plants, you're actually putting oxygen on them, so they'll breathe better, and so on. And it was something like something like a very immediate sense that they needed her presence to do their work.
Well, she is exuding her own field onto theirs, or engaging their field with hers in a nurturing way. So, the notion of composition by field comes to mind with Olson. But, the other thing is that the other connection is that if this is alive, if we see a plant being alive, or rocks, as in the animist tradition, how they're welcomed as grandfathers in the sweat lodge, then we got to believe that the poem in the moment that we're composing has some kind of intelligence, and to recognize that and to honor that by going perhaps where the poem wants to go. And that puts you in a tradition of, organic or projective or however you want to say it, where Duncan and Levertov, who were referenced last night, come in as well.
Yeah, I think so, and certainly a much more process-oriented way of writing, so that even if you set yourself a task, or I was just talking with my friend Alicia about this, but even if you set yourself a task, it's almost as if you've set the baby in a very large playpen that includes the entire universe, and you sense the limits of your own skill or interest, but within this very wide limit, you're a divine child at play in some way. So in that way, yeah, I think a process and observing oneself in action is part of what the poem is.
Like in meditation, yeah. The witness self. Talking with Brenda Hillman, the visiting poet for Fall 2011 at SPLAB in Seattle, splab.org, the website. The latest things that you've been writing in Practical Water, and I hope that you'll read a few poems from that, and also Haibun, an occasion where you persuaded your husband to stage an action at the place where the drones are piloted in Nevada, and you have a Haibun about that. Do you have that, Candy?
I can find it.
I think I took my copy there.
Okay, great.
Can you tell us a little bit about that need to create actions like that and your involvement with Code Pink, and maybe we can even talk about our trip to Occupy Seattle yesterday.
Well, for starters, I want to tell your audience that I feel as if we were saying last night that it's not only a natural thing but a necessary thing for poets to be engaged with social and political activism, and that it's not going to hurt your poetry. It'll open up avenues that they aren't necessarily overlapping disciplines or fields, but they can inform each other. They can exist side by side. They can engage. Even the most esoteric poem can be brought outdoors and done as a chant or as an action in front of others. And the particular thing that you were asking about, Bob and I went to Creech Air Force Base, which is outside of Las Vegas, Nevada, to do what I thought of as a poetic action. We decided to stand right near the gates of Creech and read poetry for 2 days, and we videotaped ourselves in this action, holding signs and doing vigils and doing the poetry reading. And it was a small group of us, Catherine Factor, Janet Wheel, Bob Hass, and me. And we brought poems of various kinds, and we read them. And what was impressive was, and interesting, was that the trucks and the guys that were going into the base really slowed down. And they would stop. They would stop to look at us. It was an odd sight to see, instead of people out there shouting or blocking the entrance necessarily, which I'm totally, in favor of. Any action you do that's a direct nonviolent action to stop people from going onto the base, to me, is helpful. But we decided just to do a poetry reading vigil. So this is the poem, and it is in the Haibun tradition, but I don't follow the formal Haibun tradition. Involves embedding the haiku, a measured haiku, into a block of prose. So I just usually put lines in front or at the end.
So it's a bun.
It's a bun. It's a bun. It's a bun that's high. Should I read this?
Yes, please.
Oh, okay. In high desert, under the drones, we are Western creatures. We can stand for hours in the sun. We read poetry near an Air Force base. Is poetry pointless? Maybe its points are moving as in a fire. The enlisted men can't hear. practice drones fly overhead to photograph our signs. They look like hornets, vespula, with dangly legs dipping in rose circles with life greens. They photograph shadows of the hills where coyotes' eyes have stars. They could make clouds of white writing, cilia, knitting, soul weaving, spine without nerves, dentures of the west, volcano experiments, geometry, weather, breath, and salt. Young airmen entering the base stare from their Hondas. They are lucky to have a job in an economy like this. The letters of this poem are also lucky to have a job, for they are insects and addicts and thieves. Volcanic basalt recalls its rock star father. Creosote and sage, stubby taupe leaves greet the rain. We hold our signs up. We're all doing our jobs. Trucks bring concrete for the landing strip. They've just begun. A cliff stands out in winter. Twin ravens drop fire from its eyes. My inner life is not so inner and maintains the vascular system of a desert plant. I'm grateful to Samuel Beckett and to my high school boyfriend, whose drunk father yelled when we closed the door and read The Unnameable during the Tet Offensive. They prepared me for this. Outside the base, we see borax mines in the distance, the colors of flesh, brown, black, peach, pink, bronze. We stand there as the young airmen settle into their routine. The Gnostics noted it is difficult to travel between spheres. You've had to memorize the secret names, and the unnameable haunts every aspect of your routine. The names grow heavier as you carry them between the spheres.
Now, if you could take out the part about the letters and how the letters start developing characteristics and the coyote stars, this would really be a political poem. And there are those who say your poems aren't political enough. What do you say to that?
Well, I think political is such a strange and mysterious term. Obviously, in the last four books, I've written about politics directly and indirectly. But I guess, as we were saying last night, the difference between what I'm interested in as the form of writing that engages me most and what might be an overtly didactic poem or a poem that would rally the crowds in a sort of anthemish way, is that I think that we bring our subtle, various forms of subtle consciousness, or theosophists would call it the subtle bodies, you know, the floating spirits or the ancestors or the fact that, to me, coyotes, you can feel the fact that coyotes are surrounding us with stars in their eyes at the same time as you can hold up your signs. And it's a much more complete human experience not to be encamped with an ideology while you're being a poet, even though ideology might take its place next to you or in you or even a desire for an outcome. Because, of course, we want the drones to end, and, of course, we're not going to be able to end them as poets. So there's that.
So it's not so much in sublimating the didactic or the ideologue in oneself, but it's reaching out to something higher and something that probably has more power than a didactic poem, and that includes the imagination.
Well, I think so, and I don't necessarily, I don't know if it's so much about hierarchies as the fact that, like, the druid, poet, priest kind of thing, the wise part of ourselves has to include the teacher, the activist, the poet, the spiritually engaged or impassioned person, without necessarily a ranking. And though, you know, we want the drones to stop, we know that as poets we're not going to necessarily be able to have that happen. We would have to be doing a different kind of action. And I wanted to say another thing about this poem is that I remembered when I was writing it, because we were actually having the drones. They aren't the drones that are in Afghanistan. They're practice drones that they fly at Creech. So you actually do see the drones, the Predator drones and the Reaper drones. And you see them taking off, and they're right next to you. And they fly. They were flying over our heads, photographing us. And they're very frightening because they're silent and they're huge. And so we would hold up our signs really flat so that they could read the signs. And so instead of just reading to the guys that were entering, or guys and women, who were entering the base with their Hondas, we were also holding the signs up. There was nobody in the drones, but the guys in the trailer could be photographing and seeing our signs. So we were trying to get the signs to be read. And, you know, the signs were not completely predictable. Like Bob's sign said, all violence is wrong except ours. It was ironic, you know. I mean, they'd have to think for a second. Yeah, you know. F and A, that's right. And then they'd say, wait, you know, like, wait, all violence, let's see, no, that's not a regular sort of, you know, average peacenik thing to say. But that's the only thing Bob wanted to write on his sign. So it was an interesting thing.
Yeah, and I can imagine, I've never been inside one of these bases where they're doing this, but I liken it to a video game, which it must be like, and can only think that the, you know, the original way you manipulated a video game was with something called a joystick.
Yeah, they pull their joysticks. And one of the things that you know, is critiqued about drone warfare is that the soldiers or the pilots of these things don't have to feel anything when they're hitting a, you know, a target-rich environment, another piece of BS language. But a target-rich environment, you know, is a small, you know, Pakistani family who's at a wedding who might have one, you know, uncle who's involved with a group.
Seen from a different perspective, where we're sitting right now here in Columbia City might be a target-rich environment.
And someday might be, you know. For either our own drones or other people's, as we continue to condone this way of behaving, of really annihilating people's bodies without the kind of moral conscience. And I said sort of jokingly to Bob when the Iraq war started and we were, you know, doing the bombing, I said, you know, really, I'd rather people be doing this with clubs. You know, like if they're going to do it, they should actually have to feel the physical presence of their violence and not this detached, disengaged horror that these machines represent.
I remember backpacking on the Pacific Crest Trail, not too far from Mount Rainier, closer to Mount Adams, I think, as I recall, and an F-16 just flew over our heads. And I could just imagine what a campesino or someone in Pakistan feels, just the complete and absolute terror.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that they are clumsy, that, you know, as much as they are supposed to be, you know, able to see the food on the plate at these weddings where they're gonna drop the bomb, they're clumsy. They're often mistakes made. They're women and children being bombed every day. And the fact that the increased use of these machines is being condoned because both our president and the vice president have come out saying this is much better for our combat troops to have this alternative.
Yeah. Talking with Brenda Hillman, visiting poet for SPLAB for fall 2011, her latest book is called Practical Water. I'm Paul Nelson. Let's go back to the book again. There's a great poem which I've used in workshops. Well, first there's an essay on page 33, and that'll be a great way to set up and give the average listener a sense of kind of what you're trying to do.
Okay. The poem is entitled Reportorial Poetry, Trance, and Activism. And it's a poem, it's a prose poem, but it is an essay. Yeah, I think it pretty much explains itself with its title. I'm interested in trance as well as activism. Reportorial poetics can be used to record detail with immediacy while one is doing an action and thinking about something else. Experience crosses over with that which is outside experience. The unknown receives this information as an aquifer receives the replenishing rain. Meditative states can be used to cross material boundaries to allow you to be in several places at once, such as Congress in ancient Babylon. I recorded notes in Washington while attending hearings and participating in actions to make the record collective and personal. Working with trance, while sitting in congressional hearings, I recorded details into a notebook. If bees can detect ultraviolet rays, there are surely more possibilities in language and government. The possible is boundless. Whether or not you have strength to resist official versions that are devastating the earth and its creatures, you could in any case send back reports. If political parties will not provide solutions, the good can occur when people gather in small groups to work for justice in each community using imagination without force. People could leave their computers at least briefly to engage with others in public spaces. It is then the potential of each word comes forward. If you have no time or strength, act without time or strength, because they may follow. In the meantime, you could imagine that you have them.
Yeah, that really sets it up well and sets up the next few poems that are in the book, and one is on the very next page, which would be great to read. What got you interested in combining these two endeavors, being an activist and being a poet? Do you remember, was there an aha moment?
Well, certainly, you know, I was a student activist in the late 60s, early 70s, and then when I was raising a family, starting to teach and writing, I was doing less direct action, and then when the Iraq War started, I mean, I've been interested in environmental activism all the way along, but when the Iraq War started, I went to a Gandhian conference on nonviolence, and I was really interested in what more you could do. And the aha moment was being at that conference and thinking, I have to do something. I'm too upset, and I'm too depressed. And I was profoundly depressed, and I felt bollocks and paralyzed. And so I thought, I'm going to go home and do something. So I started doing tax resistance, war tax resistance, which is a whole long, tale that I can tell you about. But then I decided to work with Code Pink because it was feminist and it was it had a lot of flair and humor and a lot of street theater, and I loved that. So then I started going to Washington on my own dime and just going because I thought I could have more effect that way.
And the next poem comes directly from that. It's a poem about being in a hearing and doing what you do, what you say you do in the essay. Could you read that?
Yeah. It's called In a Senate Armed Services Hearing, and it was about the confirmation of General Lute. And he had a great name, General Lute. From my position as a woman, I could see the back of the general's head, the prickly, intimate hairs behind his ears, the visible, rimless justice raining down from the eagle on the national seal, the eagle's claw-held pack of arrows and its friends. A fly was making its for sure maybe algebra cloud in the Senate chamber. It fell to us to see how senators reshuffled papers, the pity of the staples, to sense when someone coughed after the about-to-be czar general said, I don't foresee a long roll for our troops. There was a rose vibration in the rug. From its position on the table, the fly could then foresee the soon-to-be-smashed goddess as in Babylon. More perception began to be. Filaments rose from the carpet as the general spoke. The senators were stuck. What were they thinking sitting there as dutiful as lunch patrols in junior high? From my position as the fly, I could foresee as letters issued from their mouths like, General, I'd be interested to know. Some of the letters regretted that. Fibers in the carpet crouched. From the floor arose the sense the goddess Ishtar had come down to bring her astral light with a day-wrinkled plan. From my position as a thought, I thought she might. She might come in to rain her tears on Senator By and Senator Clinton, on Senator Warner in his papa tie, and Senator Levin, on Senator Reed and Senator Hill, rain tears into their water glasses. Ishtar from Babylon, they had not met before they smashed her country, now or never. Then someone, Clinton I think it was, but it might have been By, asked whether this confirmation will give breathing space for the new general to unoccupy. How do the dead breathe, Senator, from my position as a fly? And I forgot who asked what isn't even in the same syntax of this language I'm trying to make no progress in, asked how the army would unoccupy, by north or south. A voice beside my insect ear said, these senators all have their lives, kids with stuff to do, folks with cancer, some secret shame in a quotidian, the thing in front always producing panic, just like yours, the voice went, just like your life. I tried to think if this was true, but was too weak from flying above this notebook to pity them. From my position as a molecule, I could foresee 12-cent water glasses. Each bubble had an azure rim. The ovals on the senators' heads were just like them. The breath they used when saying A for American interests made the A stand still. It had a sunset clause. They tried to say safety, but the S withdrew. The S went underground. Would not be redeployed. Refused to spell. Till all the letters stopped in astral light, in dark love for their human ones.
The very first line is from your position as a woman. I mean, one can suggest that these are generals that are men that are they're making the wars, although women increasingly are getting higher up in the ranks. But how did you end up starting like that?
Lines will come, and I feel like the most important thing about writing poetry or poetry that interests me is whether you have lines that are working or not. That is memorable language. So you're sort of on the wait. You're kind of like a sea anemone or something, waiting really slowly. And I think more of a sea anemone than a Venus flytrap or something, because the sea anemone, like, it's sort of helpless and soft, and it's sort of waiting in this receptive thing till the little fish will come by, and then it'll close as slowly as possible. But you're waiting for your line like that, and if you don't really have a good line, so it comes to me, and I think if you're in training, if you're doing your writing every day, your lines will come to you as your magical force. And they come to you, and you recognize them, and you know if they're not good or if they're good. And so it came to me as I was recording the notes in my notebook just writing, rewriting, and I'll recopy when I get the notes. And then they start to shape into a poem, and this poem is particularly narrative. And as I was talking last night about undermining or mining the traditions of the narrative poem. It doesn't have to be like a realistic reportorial poem in the sense of, I'm going to only report my life. I think narrative is much bigger than that.
And the life of the fly.
And the life of the fly.
And the molecule.
And the molecule.
And the letters. Now, this is the second poem, and I didn't, it was just kind of a happy coincidence that letters are sentient and have lives and refuse to deploy and what have you. Can you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, again, it's part of the weird, I think about witty animism. And in a recent poem, I'm asking the seeds that have been engineered by Monsanto to refuse to sprout in the Central Valley. So I
hope that works.
The action that I'm suggesting to poets is that they take their poems and cut them up in tiny word seeds and mail them to the CEO of Monsanto. And like, so he'll open the envelope and all these little word seeds will fall to his lap. I mean, alas, somebody else will have to clean up the word seeds, probably not him, but at least it'll be an activism that will be somewhat absurdist. But yeah, I think I don't know, maybe it's a sort of Kabbalistic notion, but again animist, but I think that letters do kind of develop this sense of this life that's greater, and that they have a feeling or a qualified feeling. And I know John Ruskin would call that probably a pathetic fallacy or something. like you're projecting your own feeling onto them. But it's not really true, because feeling would exist whether we're here or not to feel it.
You know what? When a person arrives in Seattle, there's the Pike Place Market. Maybe see the Troll. Maybe to go to Cary Park to see the view. Although yesterday wasn't the greatest day for a view, you wanted to see Occupy Seattle.
Yes. Well, I'm very interested in the Occupy movement, and Bob and I were at Occupy Cal the other night, where there was tremendous brutality on the part of the police, and Occupy Cal and Occupy Oakland are the nearest Occupies. Well, there's Occupy Berkeley, and there's several other Occupies in the Bay Area that are wonderful. But Occupy Oakland is a very vibrant, large community right now. And I haven't been able to participate as much as I would like, but I'm very, very interested in the movement, and I love what's going on. And so I wanted to see what Occupy Seattle looked like, and was very interested to go there. I took some pictures of the signs that are completely wonderful, and you know, they—I forget the one, but they call it the American Dream, because you have to be asleep to believe it. And I love that. And unfuck. Unfuck the world. and I really love seeing the camp there, and you know, we had some interesting encounters with your friends there, that was good.
And you believe that the activist community has some, I don't want to say lessons, but information for the poetry community, and vice versa.
I do. I think they interact. I don't think there's a clear line of division. There shouldn't be a line of division. And, you know, people are going to be engaged at one level or the other, more or less. But poetry should be brought there, poetry of different kinds. And, you know, I don't think there's such a thing as a particular kind of even high modernist poetry that doesn't belong in those places. And we can listen to poetry of people that are living there right now, and we can bring poetry there and be part of the assembly. It can be part of the assembly. In Oakland, there's a group of poets that I'm on the poetics list of, you know, Occupy Oakland poets, and there's all kinds of really amazing stuff that's being fed on that list, and we're just trying to feed each other with reading material and certainly works about urban planning and things other than poetry and poetics. And we're having a really vital discussion about tactics and nonviolence, diversity of tactics, questions that are coming up in light of the violence that's been done to the community.
And you say include the people who whose instinct might be to be violent, that they should be included as well on some level.
I love teaching the Eumenides, the play, because there's a moment, and we were talking about this last night, where Athena, another name for the Eumenides is the Furies, and they're called the Furies throughout the epics, and they're always doing mischief, or more than mischief, they're burning ships and things when Aeneas tries to leave Carthage, and there's a lot of stuff that the Furies are the earth spirits, and they're coming along, and it's a very good metaphor for the sort of untamed part of the impulse in creatures, in human creatures and other creatures, but the intentional violence that needs to be done as almost a, you know, Dionysian purge or something. And my disappointment in that play always comes when Athena makes this bargain and says, now you all behave and we're going to give you this little place in our democracy, and our place for you is to do this, and like you can do your tagging on this little blackboard over here, and if you do your tagging on this blackboard, then you don't have to mark up city streets, and you don't have to do vandalism, blah blah blah. And so she changes the name to the Eumenides, and you know, everybody's supposed to be happy. Okay, democracy can function. And yet, you know, there's a war the code that you go on living by is the necessity of military violence. That is, that it's okay to go over and slaughter the, you know, Sparta or the next city state because that's sort of announced. So, in fact, the Eumenides are not tameable. There is no way. There's no way of taming the Furies. I do think you can have conversations. I do think you invite. And I, you know, I think of my grandson who has a little Furies, and you know, we all know that that's true of children. And it's true of Black Bloc participants as well, who have done their participation in the community. So you know, I've marched with the anarchists and the Black Bloc folks who people seem to be very frightened of, and I don't think that people should be excluded from the community. Now, you know. When actions begin, you have a choice of whether or not to participate, and you have a choice of whether or not to be in the way of somebody's action. And I'm not going to be the police who stops them, but, you know, other people can sign up for that job if they feel inclined.
Doesn't that hurt the movement, though, if and doesn't that allow the deployment of riot police with their, you know, helmets and their masks and their clubs? And, you know, your husband got the, you know, he got the business end of that club the other night.
Yeah, he got the business end of the club, not because any of the students started any. We were chanting peaceful protest, and there was not one, as far as I can tell, one example of student even pushback. I mean, people were holding out their hands to be arrested. And that clubbing started because those police had been told to protect a particular part of the lawn where the students were insisting that their tents belonged, because they're students at the university who were paying their fees and they wanted to make their protest. That had nothing to do with anarchists or Black Bloc people or anybody who starts with violence. I know there's a philosophy of starting with violence. It's not my philosophy. It's not my tactic. But I insist in inclusion in the community. And, you know, I think that we've made a kind of I think we have to include people, at least in the conversation, as we devise strategies and techniques and talk. So, you know, nobody is sitting down and talking to people that they're trying to exclude, or many people aren't. Occupy Oakland is. I think they're trying to be as inclusive as possible, and it's a really good community in that way.
You say the root of Occupy is to grasp or to handle. You went to your root dictionary, and you're a radical, because radical means to go to the root.
Yeah, that's true. Radical and root. And I love looking up roots. And the book that I'm working on, my fire book, actually started because Bob and I were driving a few years ago. We were driving past a field, and I was thinking about, it was in the autumn, and I was thinking about, gosh, all those pumpkins in the field, they have white eyes, and they came from these roots that go into the earth, and the roots go down, 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 and they touch the fire. And that's what every single word does, too, is touch the fire.
Yeah. And so how do you think Occupy, I mean, the Occupy movement, I mean, you know, in your poem, in the time between Practical Water, when that was published, and this moment here in time, November 12th, 2011, Occupy went from something the evil American, you know, imperialist machine does to something being done in cities all over the world as a protest to that imperialism and colonialism and violence.
Yeah, I love that about language. I love that language. I wrote a poem in an early book called Cleave and Cleave, and of course cleave and cleave both mean, one means hold tight to yourself and one means cut, and they're opposites in the same word. And I love that Occupy is now the same as cleave and cleave, that it's very much like a word that's been turned, you know, like a pancake, you know, and it's just been made to serve the interests of the redemptive, and the resistance. And that is just so cool.
Being involved in Code Pink and being involved in the Occupy movement allows you to stay uncomfortable and to be a little unhappy all the time. A couple of things you said that poets should do last night.
Yeah, I actually borrowed that idea from Salinger, that not the uncomfortable, but he said in one of his stories, J.D. Salinger, you know, the thing about being a writer is that you know that you will be a little unhappy all the time. And I would change that to be a little uncomfortable all the time, or very uncomfortable. And that doesn't mean that you can't have, you know, a good, fulfilled life and, you know, an evolved consciousness and so on. And I think of myself as a fairly joyful person. But I do not feel at ease with our capitalist system and the way things are going. And I don't think it's a matter of a gentle reform with a few tweaks. I think it needs an overhaul, and I mean an overhaul.
Aren't we living at a time in which capitalism is dying? I mean, in the next 50 years, something will replace it, because it's essentially, it's like the Ouroboros. It's eating its own tail. I mean, how long can it go? I mean, does it get to be, you know, the CEO is making 200 million times that of the lowest paid worker? That's not tenable or sustainable in any way.
I feel like when I go into some of these mega stores, I feel as if I can smell the stinking corpse of capitalism, and not just in the stores, but just in the kind of vapidity with which we have to live. And I mean, even, you know, the uncomfortableness comes in even in the fact that we have to use the kinds of machineries that are made, really, you know, by underpaid workers who are not in unions, who we insist on supporting with our government. And there's literally no other way to get a cell phone than to work. You know, you can choose a plan that may not be a horrible sellout, but chances are the machinery itself is made by underpaid workers who are really suffering. I think part of the complexity and the difficulty of being ourselves and having to get through the decades till something changes is to be miserable some part of your week about this.
Yeah. And the poem in some way gives you a little solace. Is it cathartic? I don't want to go to poetry as therapy, but there is some kind of joy that comes from writing about it, is there not?
Well, not just that, but I think like the layers that we're talking about are you know, you can layer the worst kind of difficulty and a great ecstatic pleasure in the same poem. And particularly when you're not, I feel myself relying less and less on the human to bring me joy. Not that interactions, you know, making new friends or whatever, but or you know, our trusted, beloved family relationships that we adore. We rely on human beings for our gratification and solace, but there's so much more about the universe that's so fantastic and beyond comprehension. That's a great source of amazement. That you don't really just have to stay in the socio-political realm, but I feel like you can't escape it.
Yeah, well, the Indians called the divine the great mystery, and that's the subject of another one of your tips. I wrote down these words during your talk last night: nurture indefinite states, paradox, mystery, uncertainty. Embrace the mystery of existence, living with metaphor, and there was also the phrase spiritual longing.
Yeah, I guess that's something I've sort of borrowed from the Gnostic and, you know, Ginsberg, Blake, Gnostic writers as they are. And I feel like it's part of my own heritage that I'm not really interested in getting out of. My mom is from Brazil, and she taught us early on the word for this kind of longing while you're standing in one place. You're still homesick, which is saudades, which is the longing for. It's sort of a homesickness, but it's really beyond homesickness. It's kind of a yearning that can't be satisfied. And I think of it as a Gnostic longing that's like, there's a home elsewhere that I'm not counting out getting back there. And it's not like we should all, you know, drink the Kool-Aid and die, you know, in order to get on the satellite and carry us back to the only heaven there is. I think heaven is here. And I think also there are the unknown places in a greater existence that we can't be so arrogant as to think that there aren't other states.
Is there a poem that you'd like to leave us with today?
Well, on that note, I guess I could say...
I love the poem that's for the watershed, and I think that's really important. And I also think that could have been a topic of conversation, how we go to the local and the national or the federal gets less relevant. We start buying our food from the local farmer's market or maybe even grow it on the corner empty lot, and we start making a lot of these bigger systems irrelevant. That might be one strategy, and I think that's one that is being used more and more, especially around here.
Yes, definitely. In that poem, it's probably a little too long to read, but it's called Berkeley Water, and I gently tease the Berkeley culture for their interaction with with vegetables and fruits in the farmers market. But I'd actually like to end with in the trance poem, which is this kind of short poem. I've done hypnotherapy for a lot of years with a practitioner, and then I've done it myself. And there's a whole set of figures that I encounter in when I'm kind of in a trance state. And one of them turned out to be an anarchist, and I address her in the poem, or she addresses me in the trance. A pretty anarchist said to me, "It's not that a great love happens. What happened became your great love." Her echo had an ancient glow and so proved buoyant for my little craft. I left the world and felt a world. The bee loading its gloves with powder, the albatross wanting one thing from the sea. "Nothing can wreck our boat," said she. And when the water felt the glacier, the future held a present tense, the present held a future without cease.
Well, it's just been a great delight to have you in town. Thank you so much for being here and for your work, and we hope to see you again soon.
I hope to be back, and I'll keep reporting on the fire.
Thank you. Brenda Hillman has been our guest, the visiting poet for SPLAB for fall 2011. The SPLAB Visiting Poet Series is made possible in part by contributions from 4 Culture and poets and writers.